From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ricky Gervais, the creator and star of the BBC series The Office, which was adapted into the NBC series of the same name. Gervais also co-created and stars in the HBO comedy series Extras, which begins a new season next January, and he's in the new movie Night at the Museum. Also, jazz box sets that won't break the bank. Kevin Whitehead has some gift suggestions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Ricky Gervais. He created and starred in the BBC series The Office and is an executive producer of NBC's adaptation. Each version is a mockumentary set in a small branch of a paper company that's headed by a manager who thinks he's a generous, funny, and wise leader, but unfortunately is none of those things. Gervais also co-created and stars in the HBO comedy series Extras, which begins its new season in January. And Gervais is in the new movie, Night at the Museum, a comedy starring Ben Stiller as Larry, the new night watchman in a natural history museum. He's horrified to discover that at night, after everyone but him has gone home, all the exhibits come to life, the dinosaurs, Neanderthal men, and the historical figures like Teddy Roosevelt and Attila the Hun. Gervais plays the museum director, Dr. McPhee. In this scene, from early in the film, McPhee is very upset because children are touching the exhibits.
Please don't touch the exhibits!
I mean, riffraff. Miss Huttman, I cannot tolerate this type of chaos. I mean, this is a museum, not a...
Do you know what museum means?
It doesn't mean, ooh, Daddy, it's a big Tyrannosaurus thing. Can I touch his leg? No! Work it out, please.
Will do, sir.
Thank you.
Dr. McPhee, the museum director.
Seems like a fun guy.
Control you, young, please. Can we?
That's Ricky Gervais, Carla Gugino, and Ben Stiller. Stiller was a guest star in the first season of Gervais's HBO series Extras. I asked Ricky Gervais if he took this small part in Night at the Museum because of his friendship with Stiller.
I got an email from him out of the blue saying, doing this film, there's a part for you. Do you want to return the favour? No pressure. And I did. And I did want to return the favour. And I read the script and I thought, this is fantastic. It's not the film that I'd have thought I'd have done for my first sort of Hollywood film. But
it was fantastic.
Hollywood film? Wow. Yeah. Well, sort of in the sense that Hollywood blockbuster, I had recorded For Your Consideration before.
That's right.
By Hollywood, I mean Hollywood blockbuster, and For Your Consideration is a tiny, tiny budget. And it's fantastic. I love Christopher Guest. He's probably the biggest influence on my work. Night at the Museum was great fun. It was 3 days. I call it a cameo. I've jumped straight to cameo now. I missed out the 20 years, the film career. I just went straight to cameo. I'm like Roger Moore. And this is the difference between Hollywood and a low budget film. They flew me and my girlfriend first class. We went in this beautiful hotel, this 5-star hotel in Vancouver. I went and my trailer was amazing. And Sean Levy, the director, bounced over to me and said, "Ricky, great to have you. Is everything okay? Is your trailer okay?" I said, "The trailer's bigger than my hotel room." He went, "Do you want a bigger hotel room?" That's the difference, you see. that's the sort of treatment I want.
Now, you mentioned that Christopher Guest has been such a big influence on your work. I imagine what you mean is his version of mockumentary, in which it's this
exactly.
kind of fake documentary, kind of like The Office is.
Absolutely. Direct influence on The Office, Spinal Tap, yeah.
So, did you talk with him about that when you were in his latest movie?
We actually became friends before the film because he was a fan of The Office, and I understand him and his wife, Jamie Lee Curtis, they gave The Office, the English version of The Office, his presence. And I spoke to him, and then he came over to England and we met up, and I always meet up with him when we go to LA. And we became friends over the last couple of years anyway. And again, he wrote a part especially for me, and there's some things you don't say no to. So, The Simpsons, Christopher Guest, Ben Stiller. I don't do much, but I know when something very good comes along.
Now, I want to ask you about Extras, which is your HBO series that's coming back in mid-January. And for any of our listeners who haven't ever seen Extras, I'm going to ask you to describe the premise of your series.
Well, I play an actor called Andy Millman. In the first season, he was a struggling extra, just trying to get a line. But it's about these sort of lost souls, really. And the second season starts with Andy having got his pilot made, and now he's making the series, which is a sitcom called When the Whistle Blows. And it's not turned out like he wanted it to. It's its lowest common denominator. It's got catchphrases in it and funny wigs. And it's about him really, you know, signing with the devil. He took it on even though he knew it wasn't what he wanted to do. And now it's his struggle. And I suppose it's, you know, be careful what you wish for, because he's got fame, but no respect.
Yeah, I remember the last time you were on Fresh Air, you talked about how you didn't really understand why people just want fame. Like a lot of people, it's not even that they want to be great at something. Like they want to be a great actor, a great musician. They just want to be famous.
Absolutely true. And I think I told you at the time that that survey, when the university survey amongst 10-year-old children, they asked what they wanted to be when they grew up, and they said famous. You know, not famous for something, just famous. I think people, you know, they're aiming at something else really. What they mean is, you know, acceptance or love or even attention, and they think that that'll sort everything out. And of course, it doesn't, because fame per se is. I mean, I think fame per se is worse than anonymity. Why would you want that? Why would you just want to be recognised or looked at? I think they sort of mistake it for respect.
Yeah, so the new season is kind of about being famous for things that are ultimately kind of embarrassing.
Well, exactly. He finds out that, you know, infamy is not a good thing. Fame without respect is not a good thing. And he's made the wrong decisions because the alternative at the time was scarier. He didn't want to be a struggling extra. So when he's standing at that crossroads and the head of the BBC says, what do you want to do? Do you want to make the sitcom or do you want to go back to being an extra? Against his better judgment, you know, and this is, you know, I'm not really saying what's right for everyone. It just turned out to be not right for him.
Is the sitcom that you've created for extras based on real sitcoms in England?
Well, yeah, there are, it's a Frankenstein of things that have happened. It's really that lowest common denominator comedy that tries to please everyone. It's a bit, you know, it's based on things that have gone before. It's very easy. It relies on just catchphrases that people are, you know, pick up on. Like, it's aimed at sort of like half wits and their children. It's gurning, it's funny faces, and he sort of like he was led down the wrong road. And we also make, as the reviews get worse and he gets more depressed, the ratings go up and the merchandising starts selling. And he can't enjoy any of it because he knows how shallow it is, and he knows that he can't take it back. He can't take it back. It's out there. You know?
No, you knew that you wanted this sitcom to revolve in a way around catchphrases. So you had to come up with a catchphrase for your character, a catchphrase that would be like really stupid. So,
well, exactly.
How did you do it? How did you think of like, what's the stupidest catchphrase I can come up with for this?
Well, one that's very easy, that sort of means nothing. And, you know, one that you would say anyway. I think that's, you know, catchphrases are easy enough. But ones that are just a normal phrase in the English language is the laziest of all. So you're having a laugh. And, of course, he says it incessantly. And he gets a laugh from the audience. But then he realises it's because the audience are morons. And he can never find... He can never find any joy or satisfaction in his work anymore. And he sort of... All he craves now is credibility. And, of course, he makes bad decisions based on that as well. He says, get me a play. But he's a fish out of water. He doesn't like the people that hang around and shout his catchphrase at him because he thinks they're idiots. So he tries to go up market. He tries to get into a VIP lounge, but of course he's not accepted there because he's not respected. So he has to go back, and he's just a fish out of water because he's made the wrong choice.
So you know, people are always coming up to him and begging him to do the catchphrase. Have you actually seen that happen with people, that they get stuck with a catchphrase and they have to do it for everybody who they meet? I don't think you've been in that position, have you?
No. Although a couple of people, I was at Live 8, the big concert, mm-hmm. and it was about 250,000 people there, and someone shouted, do the dance. And then 250,000 people demanded I did the dance. And as it was for charity, I did the dance. But that's all right. That's all right. It was for charity.
And you were on stage. You were on stage.
Of course. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I wasn't in the audience. No, that would have been
strange. You were supposed to be performing. You weren't having a quiet moment in a cafe.
Yeah. I was actually introducing REM. But it felt right to do it. And it was very funny and good humoured. But no, no one really... I don't do catchphrases. Although I noticed after Extras went out in England, even though it was ironic and we were saying... how awful and easy it was, and people who shout them are morons. People shout with it to me. Are you having a laugh? And I'd have to go, oh, yeah, well done.
I didn't think of that.
Exactly. Okay, right. Oh, you've missed the point then. Oh, good. Oh, hi. Have a nice day. You know, but what can you do? It's all good. It's all nice.
There's a great scene this season in Extras with David Bowie. And in this episode, you've basically like, bribed your way into sitting next to Bowie at the VIP part of a nightclub. He's at the piano. And so your character just starts complaining to David Bowie.
Well, of course.
About this horrible sitcom that he's in.
Well, he thinks he's got more in common with David Bowie than the people there because they're both entertainers. And, even the bouncer points out that, you know, David Bowie is one of the most seminal artists of the last 35 years doing work that's tantamount to genius. You've come up with a camp catchphrase-based comedy where you wear wigs. And he goes, right, brilliant, I've got a bad review off a bouncer. And he spills his heart to David Bowie because he wants a bit of, you know, sympathy. And, of course, that we portrayed David Bowie as this strange, you know, genius who just takes in all this information and then just starts writing a song about it. And, of course, it's less than flattering.
It was incredibly unflattering.
Yeah.
How would you feel if we played a little bit of David Bowie singing the song that he writes after talking to your character?
I'd love it.
Hi.
Hi. We were just saying that I'm an entertainer too.
Oh, yeah? What do you do?
I'm in a sitcom.
It's called When the Whistle Blows. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no. Is it any good?
Nice.
Oh, just riffraff everywhere.
Not going down too well, huh?
Getting 6 million viewers. I mean, it's not exactly how I meant it to be because the BBC have interfered and sort of chased ratings and made it the lowest common denominator, sort of comedy, sort of catchphrases and wigs. And I think I've sold out, to be honest. But
yeah,
it's difficult, isn't it, to keep your integrity when you're going for that first...
Little fat man who sold his soul.
The little...
Little fat man who sold his dream. Chubby little loser. Chubby little loser. National joke. No, not chubby little loser. No. Pathetic little fat man. No one's bloody laughing. The clown that no one laughs at. They all just wish he'd die. He's so depressed at being useless. The fat man takes his own life.
No.
He's so depressed at being hated. Fatty takes his own life.
Fatso.
I like Fatso.
Yeah, let's go with Fatso. Fatso takes his own life. He blows his bloated face off.
No.
He blows his stupid brains out.
But the I'd probably miss.
Yes, Linda, I like that.
Yeah, so do I. It's brilliant, Linda.
He sold his soul for a shot at fame. Catchphrase and wig and the jokes are lame. He's got no style, he's got no grace. He's banal and facile, he's a fat waste of space.
Yeah. Everybody sing that last line. One, two, three.
He's banal and facile, he's a fat waste of space. See his pop, no space.
So that's the song that David Bowie writes about your character, Ricky Gervais. And, of course, you wrote the lyric for the song. So you're writing the lyric to a song mocking yourself or mocking your character.
The lyrics were done before, David put the music to it, and we sent them off to him. And then he flew in the day before we filmed, and he said, this is the music. And he played it, and it was just fantastic. And, a co-write with David Bowie. It doesn't get better than that.
My guest is Ricky Gervais. His HBO comedy series Extras begins its new season in mid-January. He's in the movie Night at the Museum, which opens this week. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ricky Gervais, and he created and co-starred in The Office and then had a hand in the creation of the American version of it, which is on NBC. His HBO series, The Extras, starts up again in mid-January, and he also has a small part in the new movie Night at the Museum. You know, when I first heard that there was going to be an American version of The Office, I winced because I figured, oh, you know, the British version's so good. Like, it's such a great series, and the American version is going to probably get it all wrong. And I am proud to say, glad to say anyways, that I was really wrong. It's terrific.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's amazing. And when we came out to do The Office, we had no track record. We had nothing to... you know, compare it to. There was no prejudice towards us. You know, it was a little surprise for people. Whereas when they started trying to make it for America, the eyes of the media are on them, and they overcame that brilliantly. I think they stuck to their guns. We met with Greg Daniels, and we thought he's the right man for the job. And you know, we've certainly been proved right there.
How did Steve, he prove to you that he was the right man for the job?
He was quiet. He was quiet and sensitive, and he really, really liked the Tim and Dawn story, and you know, he hated the idea of a laugh track. He hated the idea of gagging it up. He really loved the idea of this ensemble piece, and he knew it was about the mood. He knew The Office was more to do with mood, and realism and empathy than jokes and convoluted plots. And he said all the right things, And we liked him, and we liked his, you know, the work he'd done before, and he was great. He was fantastic, and we knew we were in good hands there. And you know, then it was will NBC let him do what we know he can do, and they did. They were incredible. You know, hats off. They could have panicked. They could have watered it down. I think it got. I got a really depressed email from Greg early on saying it scored really, really badly on the focus group. And I sent back, brilliant, so did we. We got the joint lowest ever on BBC Two.
Wow, really?
I think joint bottom with Women's Bowls. And so I thought that's a great omen. What are focus groups now? You ask them a question, they think they've got to answer you, whether they've got an opinion or not. And NBC went, you know what, we're going to go with this again. And they're fantastic.
Now, how would you compare the character you played in The Office, David Brent, with Steve Carell's character, Michael Scott? Because they're different.
I think maybe Michael Scott's a little slicker. He's a little smarter. He's possibly even a little nicer than David Brent. But David Brent, I think he's more troubled in a way. I think he's a man free-falling, and there's definitely more of an underlying threat of breakdown with David Brent than Michael Scott. But then they should be different. America's different to England. American offices are different to English offices. And Steve Carell, he's playing a different character. He's playing Michael Scott and not David Brent, and nor should he.
Visually, one of the signatures of The Office, both the BBC and the NBC versions, is the pained looks that the people who work in the office always have when their boss is talking.
Yeah.
And that kind of pained look, ever since you did The Office, ever since you created The Office, that kind of pained look has become an almost staple of other TV shows and even like commercials in America. I just see that a lot. And I always feel like it's often just, you know, copying The Office.
Well, I'm sure they're influenced by The Office on some of the... I know the ones you mean, and I certainly think, oh, that looks a bit like The Office. But, you know, we didn't invent it. Documentaries are a real thing. We emulated documentary, and sometimes people look at the camera. In more postmodern cases, from Laurel and Hardy to Gary Shandling, they break the fourth wall. But we were doing it because it was meant to be a real documentary, and also because empathy was the important thing. We had this documentary. We had to keep reminding people the reason why these people were acting like this was because they were being filmed, and they knew they were being filmed. If you lost the documentary aspect, it would just be, it would be nothing. It would be a very, very boring, poor sitcom without laughs or interesting plot lines. So we had to remind people why these people were acting like this. The other thing is that it drew people in. So it was a tool I used all the time as David Brent to show that he was saying this because there was a camera. Sometimes he'd say something, philosophical, or, told people, he did a lot for charity, and he'd look at the camera to go, did you get that? That's what sort of guy I am. Also, if he was caught lying, he would look at the camera going, oh God, they caught that, of course, I'm being filmed. So it was, swings and roundabouts. Tim used it to go, are you listening to this nonsense? This is the world I'm in. Save me. And it brought the viewer into it. When David Brent embarrassed himself and he looks at you, you go, oh my God, he's looking at me. What can I do? Oh, it's even worse. It's more excruciating. When Tim looked at the camera, you felt for him because Tim was you. Tim was you at home watching. There has to be a normal person amongst all the madness. Because, as I say, it's all about empathy, comedy and drama. You have to engage with the audience.
Ricky Gervais will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews four box sets, and we continue our conversation with Ricky Gervais.
Chances are I'd be faithful to you, chances are I'd be mindful to do all things that would impress you, till you'd confess that I'm your happiness. Chances are, if you let me implore, with my love you'd be asking for more. But sweetheart, before I go too far, tell me what my chances are.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor and writer Ricky Gervais. He co-created and starred in the BBC series The Office and is an executive producer of the NBC adaptation. He also co-created and stars in the HBO comedy series Extras. The new season starts in mid-January, and the first season comes out on DVD January 9th. You can also see Gervais in the new movie Night at the Museum. Now, you wrote an episode recently of The Simpsons, and this was a really funny episode that it's Homer Simpson. The Simpsons participate basically in a reality show that's like a wife swap. So yeah. So Homer gets a different wife and Marge gets a different husband.
Yeah,
and you play the husband who, you know, the other husband who is matched up with Marge, and you actually seem to really fall in love with her and woo her.
Well, I play this guy who's in a sort of loveless marriage, and he's married above his station. You know, his wife's, you know, more educated, a higher class than him, and she sort of despises him for his failure. And Marge is nice to him, and it's suddenly like, oh my God, there's a nice person out there. And he falls for her, but really it's fun to have a swipe at TV. That, you know, it's what I've done for my very short career, and it's what The Simpsons do absolutely brilliantly. So it seemed a sort of a nice natural fusion that we'd come together over something to do with, you know, docu-soap, reality TV, and of course embarrassment, which seems to be the thing of the decade.
Well, you get to do a song in this, and I love it when you write and perform songs. So I thought we'd listen to the song that you wrote for the character, for this husband who's trying to, you know, woo Marge. And do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
Well, again, it's like, the, you know, David Brent. I always try and write a song in anything that I'm in, because I'm a frustrated and failed musician. So this is a nice outlet. But just like the songs in The Office, they weren't spoof songs. They were inappropriate. So the fun is that this is just an inappropriate song to sing to a woman you're trying to woo. So yeah, that's where the fun is. It's It's just not the right thing to do.
Well, let's hear it.
Oh, who left this here? Did I tell you I'm a bit of a songwriter? Words and music, hold the applause. I wrote this song for a woman. You.
Yeah, what an odd thing for a man who's not interested in me to do.
Yes, not interested. Let me just breathe your scent for a moment before I play. Lady, when you came to me, I was feeling blue. Blue just like your hair, you see. Blue just like the moon. But only when the moon is blue, and not when it is cream. And now that you are here with me, I am in a dream. Oh yeah, Marge, your dreams can come true. Lady, when you go away, I feel like I could die. Not like die like your hair is dyed, but die like Lady Di. And not like die like her name is Di, but die like when she died. Ooh. But lady, just like Lady Di, be my princess tonight, but don't die.
That song was very nice.
That's Ricky Gervais singing in an episode of The Simpsons.
That's his best attempt.
That's really terrific. In addition to all the Lady Di stuff, what I really love about that song is the lady.
Of course.
I hate
trying
songs
to be cool.
That call women lady.
Lady, of course. Yeah, that real Las Vegas midlife crisis. Hello, yeah. Yeah. You just imagine his shirt undone down to his navel.
Yeah. The songs that use the word lady, they're always just both so like condescending and narcissistic at the same
yeah,
time.
Lady, yeah. Like these people, they know about women. Yeah. I tell you about ladies. Yeah.
So, do you still like perform musically, like for real?
Oh, no. Only behind the safety shield of irony. I'm too embarrassed now to do it for real. I failed once. It's the public's fault. I failed once. I'm not doing it again unless I'm taking the mic.
What was your performing self like when you were doing it for real?
I suppose I probably wanted to be a bit like David Bowie. I'd say is a rough and ready guide to my my career attempt at singing.
Complete with gender bending?
Well, within reason, yeah. Oh, God, yeah, new romantic. Oh, eyeliner the lot, back-combed hair. I didn't put on dresses or ladies' underwear, but, you know. People get these pictures of me. In fact, Conan showed one last night, and, of course, it's everywhere laughing because it's embarrassing because I was 9 stone with cheekbones and eyeliner. But I explained that I'm not embarrassed about how I look then. I'm embarrassed about how I look now. And that just reminds me.
My guest is Ricky Gervais. His HBO comedy series Extras begins its new season in mid-January. And he's in the new movie Night at the Museum, which opens this week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ricky Gervais, and he's the creator of The Office, which of course now has an American version on NBC. He's in the new movie Night at the Museum, and his HBO series Extras starts up again in mid-January. Now, your writing partner is Stephen Merchant, who plays your agent on Extras. How did you guys first meet and start working together?
I got a job in a local radio station, and I gave Steve a job as my assistant, and he was fresh out of college, and he wanted to get into comedy, and so I remember consciously thinking, oh, I better show him I'm funny too. And I had this character I used to do that I was going to, you know, that could have been a sketch character, and it was called Seedy Boss, and it was basically David Brent. And when Steve left the radio station, he did a course at the BBC. And he had to do a little training thing, and he said, "Oh, let's film your character." And we went back to my old office, we filmed for a day. We just, you know, extras that were, you know, people actually working there and a couple of friends, and we did a little pilot, a 20-minute pilot of The Office, and that's how it started, and it was basically the scene in episode 5, series 1, where I give the girl an interview, and I'm quite lascivious and a little bit creepy, and that was Seedy Boss. Brent changed after that. Really, we made him less creepy and less sort of sexist because we thought he'd lose all sympathy. But that's the hangover of when he was called Seedy Boss. That's how I met Steve, and that was I think about 1997.
So you and your writing partner, Stephen Merchant, along with a third person named Carl Pilkington, do these podcasts together that have become like really popular. And it sounds like you're basically just improvising together, often at Carl's expense.
Absolutely.
Who is he? And maybe you could, like, for listeners who haven't heard it, describe the kind of interactions that you have on these podcasts.
Well, Carl is, I'd say, just a... You know, he's a normal bloke. He was doing a job of work at the radio station, and then when myself and Stephen, you know, just started chatting to him, we realised he saw the world differently to other people, let's say. And he's fascinating. He's got an opinion on everything, and it's, you know, what you think is the wrong opinion, to be honest. He doesn't quite understand science or art. But he's got a fascinating take on things, and we just chat, and he's hilarious. He's just one of the funniest people I've ever met. He's like a real Homer Simpson. For example, we got a Christmas podcast that goes live on Christmas Day, and I was explaining to Carl, you know, the wise men, the magi, the three wise men that brought gifts to Jesus, and Carl said, "Were those presents for his birthday or Christmas?" And it's just things like that. And he was going, but the bloke who brought gold, what did he get him next year? You see, he's peaked. And it's just fascinating how he sees the world. He always comes down on... We were talking about looking back on the year. We were going about all fascinating things like, you know, the growing violence in Iraq, you know, the popularity of George W. Bush, all these things. And we said to Carl, what stood out for you? And he said, I saw a grub eating a biscuit. And we went, what do you mean? He said, I was having a biscuit with my tea and I put it down and I saw this grub I'd never seen before. It was see-through and it had legs. And I thought, even though he couldn't be further away from who I am, we both enjoy a biscuit. And it's things like that that captures his imagination. It's just the little things in life. And I want to get inside his head. Myself and Stephen see ourselves as like Anthony Hopkins in The Elephant Man, just taking around this strange oddity to the world. And, you know, it must have inflamed some people's imagination because, you know, they downloaded it and he's become quite a cult phenomenon. You know, we're in the Guinness Book of Records for the most downloads ever. And that's because people want to hear Carl's opinion on things. He's incredible. Talking about The Elephant Man, there's a scene in that film where he's stripped off in front of all these surgeons and doctors, and he's going, see the deformation of the skull and the spine and the legs and the arms. The genitals are untouched. They're totally normal. And Carl said, think of that. The one thing you would want like an elephant, and he gets the head. He's fantastic.
You've compared Carl to Homer Simpson. That's never said as a compliment. So how does he feel about the role he plays on these podcasts as the kind of very smart guy? Yeah,
I think it is a compliment. Homer Simpson is my hero. I'm an atheist, and so Homer is the closest thing I have to God. And Carl Pilkington is a bit like him. You know, he's just different. There's something in his head that works differently to most people's brains. Talking about it, he asked me a question on one podcast. He said, are you in charge of the brain or is the brain in charge of you? And I don't know how to answer. I don't know where to start with the question, but he's always thinking. He's trying to teach himself now, and he's fascinated by, you know, learning, and his questions are... He's quite a philosopher. You know, he just keeps asking why. Why? And then, you know, unfortunately, he tries to fill in the gaps himself sometimes. I it's my favourite thing I do, sit in a room with Carl and ask his opinion on stuff.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Ricky Gervais co-created and stars in the HBO comedy series Extras, which begins its new season in mid-January. He co-created and starred in the BBC series The Office and is an executive producer of the NBC adaptation. And he plays the museum director in Night at the Museum, which opens this week. Next week, we're going to feature a special holiday series of our favorite recent interviews with great performers who've written great songs, like Ray Davies, Iggy Pop, Tom Petty, Andre Benjamin of Outkast, Leonard Cohen, and Smokey Robinson. Here's Smokey with some shopping advice that's not about holiday gifts.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
Yeah.
interview with Smokey Robinson will be broadcast Monday. If you're still shopping for holiday gifts, our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of 4 box sets after a break. This is Fresh Air. For his holiday gift picks this year, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead recommends 4 new or recent boxes of 3 CDs each, 2 of them bargains, and none quite expensive enough to break the bank. To get things rolling, here's some Fats Waller.
Fats Waller on electric organ with Al Casey on guitar, 1941. One classy gift for the jazz fan this season is Waller's If You Got to Ask, You Ain't Got It, 3 CDs worth of tunes he recorded between 1926 and 43. It ropes in all the Fats Wallers, the solo pianist, band pianist, pipe organist, cheeky singer of his own and other people's tunes, and all-round winning personality. One of the last century's great entertainers, Waller was also a fine songwriter. 1938's Hold My Hand sounds like it was written for Fred Astaire, with Astaire's kind of elegance, verbal wit, and terpsichorean bounce. But the delivery is pure Fats.
Am I happy? Tickles me. There's no telling how I feel. Since I met you, I can't think. I keep wondering, is this real? Come on and hold my hand. Let's dance all night together, hand in hand, as lightly as a feather. Hold my hand. There's romance in the weather. You and me, merrily, tip, tip, tipping in harmony. Kiss.
This Fats Waller anthology is one you can really spend some time with. The handsome program book includes a long, long appreciation by Dan Morgenstern.
Any hokum now?
Another lavishly documented new 3 CD box dealing with music from between the world wars is devoted to the string bass. It starts in 1925, when the bass fiddle was more rare on record than on gigs because it was hard to record. The anthology, How Low Can You Go, is on Dust to Digital, a labor of love label with a weakness for old, weird Americana. The box casts a wide net, taking in famous and obscure jazz groups, but also Latin, calypso, country, gospel, blues, Hawaiian, and jug bands. A full disc is given over to bassist Bill Johnson, who led the first nationally acclaimed jazz group, the unrecorded Creole Band, which plied the vaudeville circuit in the 1910s. And there are 2 numbers by bass woman Thelma Terry with a teenage Jean Krupa on drums. The music in the bass box was chosen with obvious care, And there's plenty of limber, percussive pluck and slap from Pops Foster, Walter Page, John Kirby, and Milt Hinton. But sometimes, an insomniac's tick-tock beat is enough. Here's Carol Waldron on a 1933 blues by Dickie Wills' Shim Shammers. Variety and a sense of fun make How Low Can You Go a painless history lesson. The same goes for saxophonist Sonny Stitt's Stitt's Bits, the bebop recordings, 1949 to 1952, on three CDs from Prestige. You may not buy annotator Harvey Pekar's argument that Stitt was a pioneer of 1940s bebop and not just the first of umpteen imitators of Bop King Charlie Parker. But Stitt ducked the comparison by moving away from Parker's alto toward tenor and baritone saxes. The bigger horns let him find his own deeper voice to complement the quick fingers. That's Shadow Wilson on drums. The Sonny Stitt box works because of the range of settings he recorded in around 1950. He waxed pretty ballads and jumping blues, beefed up his small groups with extra horns or mambo percussion, backed up singers, and engaged in many friendly battles with fellow tenor and baritone man Gene Ammons. He's the set's featured co-star. Sounds kind of like Dylan's basement tapes 17 years early. I wonder if Ammons and Stitt got accused of selling out for that. And finally, something totally else. Our last three-disc pick is Andrew Hill's solo from the Mail Order Mosaic label. It's 3 hours of singular piano music from 1978, most of it unreleased till now. As composer, Hill has a knack for embedding catchy phrases into haunting tunes. Here he obsesses on his melodies, pouring over them for 15 minutes at a stretch and proceeding in fits and starts. Every time he cycles back through a tune's form, it's as if he starts from scratch instead of building on the last round. It sounds nutty, but he gives every pass the breezy informality of a pencil sketch. Andrew Hill's solo method is so mysterious, the music's texture so often oddly spare, it keeps pulling you back in. It's mysterious, but light on the ears. One thing the Hill, Fats Waller, Sonny Stitt, and string bass boxes all have in common, besides blessedly ungimmicky packaging, is that the music's so rich, it keeps yielding new details, new secrets every time you listen. That way, a lucky recipient will still have plenty to discover long after the tinsel's in the trash and the tree is on the curb.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas and is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. You'll find a list of the box sets he reviewed on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm the world's most happy creature. Tell me what can worry be. I'm crazy about my baby. Baby, crazy about me. Mr. Cupid was the teacher. And the reason we agree. I'm crazy about my baby. Baby, crazy about me. Parson, get that book. Pull it in your hand. Keep a steady lookout. You can understand. It's an A1 combination, perfect he and she. I'm crazy about my baby, baby crazy about me, yeah. All right then, baby, yeah. You know I love it. Bring it on out here, yeah. You gonna give me some, huh? Well, that's a killer.
Support for NPR comes from Concord Records, presenting Ray Sings Basie Swings, new performances by the Count Basie Orchestra with classic Ray Charles vocals, available at Starbucks. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start January 8th at capella.edu. And from Universal Pictures, presenting The Good Shepherd, starring Matt Damon, Angelina Jolie, and Robert De Niro, in theaters Friday, directed by Robert De Niro. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Cizik, vice president of the lobby group, the National Association of Evangelicals. He's added global warming to his list of concerns, and he's been criticized for it by many evangelical leaders. The president of Cizik's group, Ted Haggard, resigned after allegations that he paid for the services of a male prostitute. Join us for the next Fresh Air.